You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and for the rest of the hour, a look at the theory of evolution, or you might call it the evolution of evolution. Everyone associates the theory of evolution with Charles Darwin, but of course he didn't just wake up one day, jot down an idea about the origin of species. Many scientists before had pondered the question of where species come from. And of course, the Bible offers an explanation that even many scientists in Darwin's day accepted. So what was it that Darwin did that no one before him had done? Or what did he see and realize? What light bulbs went off in his head that other people, you know, hadn't seen the light? And why does history record Darwin as the father of evolution? Should there be others? Should there be others who share the credit with Darwin? What about Alfred Russel Wallace or Lamarck? How did their ideas influence and shape Darwin's theory? That's what we'll be talking about this hour, and you're welcome to join our discussion. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guest. Edward J. Larson is Richard B. Russell Professor of History and Talmadge Professor of Law at the University of Georgia. He is the author of several books on the history of science. His book, Summer for the Gods, won the 1998 Pulitzer Prize in History. His new book is Evolution, the Remarkable History of a Scientific Theory, just out by Random House. He joins us from the studios of WFYI in Indianapolis. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Larson.
Delighted to be back. Thanks.
It doesn't seem like you run out of things to talk about with Darwin, do you?
No. I think I could continue to write for the rest of my life, and it only would get more exciting.
Why do you say that?
There's so much there, and it has made such a tremendous difference over the last 150 years, and it continues to make a difference. We're learning more about Darwin, but with this book, I don't limit myself, of course, to Darwin. I do, as you said in your introduction, talk about the history of the theory of evolution, which reaches from before Darwin, but especially in the years after Darwin, is profoundly rich and continues to be.
You start your story with the evolution of George Cuvier. Why did you start there?
Well, as any historian, you have to start somewhere, and there's a danger to start this story with the ancient Greeks. And when you do that, you sort of go so far back, you're talking about philosophy. By the time you get up to the hard science that really influenced the development of evolution, you may have lost the reader. Mm-hmm. Cuvier was the one who really burst the limits of time. That was his own phrase. He was a remarkable paleontologist and geologist. He had research materials that were not available to anybody before him, thanks to his particular place in time, being head of the Museum of Natural History in Paris at the time that Napoleon was conquering Europe. And at a time when science was so dominant in the purposes of France. Uh-huh. So they brought back to him a rich array of fossil evidence and geological evidences. And through that, he was able to make convincing arguments that the Earth was very old, far longer than any sort of biblical time frame, and that there had been epochs of time, and that there were distinctively different species in those different species. That is, that there was extinction and there was appearance of new kinds over time. Now, he didn't interpret that in an evolutionary framework. He interpreted that as a series of special creations. But that sort of viewpoint, a long period of time and a progressive appearance of new species, such as an age of fish following an age of reptiles, following an age of mammals, that sort of world, that sort of science made possible the breakthroughs, laid the foundations for evolutionary thought.
And what was the motivation to create this history? Was it to sort of trace in nature what the Bible was talking about the progression of creation?
Well, Cuvier was a profound comparative anatomist, and I think he had sincere scientific motives. He was religious himself, but he was very careful to divorce his science from his religion. it may be that his religious views helped him tie him to this idea of special creation. But it wasn't a special creation as described in Genesis, where in six literal days all the earth was created. Rather, it was a long period of time, and there were successive appearances and disappearances of species. He came to that through his scientific observations. It was the only way he could explain the evidence that he found.
So why didn't he become Darwin?
He didn't become Darwin in part because of the way he interpreted the evidence. He felt that there was such a complexity in these organisms, and he was probably the greatest comparative anatomist up to his time. Mm-hmm. He didn't see how one could evolve to another. Further, he saw geologic epochs that were distinctively different. So he didn't see that gradual change over time. He saw catastrophic sort of divisions in the geologic record where, say, the age of reptiles, where dinosaurs would rule, would be followed by an age of mammals, mm-hmm. and that these were fundamentally different. So with this sort of scientific observations, he wasn't inclined toward an evolutionary worldview. But we can't divide this from his philosophical views. He had grown up during the period of the French Revolution, when the French Revolution, which at first excited him, turned into what he viewed as a terribly horrible experience, where scientists were killed, where leaders were killed, where there was mass executions. And he wanted there to be an order. And he was part of reconstructing a new order after the revolution. He rose to high governmental positions. Now, evolution had always been connected with the more radical viewpoint. It had had a radical tint. Lamarck, who was already proposing it, had much more a radical agenda. It had been proposed earlier by some who were in the French Enlightenment, who had been very critical of the monarchy and ended up playing, or at least viewed as playing into what developed as the French Revolution. Uh-huh. So to him, the search for order, he found that order in science and did more than anyone up to his time in documenting it.
But and as you say, that the idea of evolution was being developed among many people there, but the idea of how the evolutionary steps were not clear. The natural selection part, that part was not in place. Was that up to Darwin to come up with?
Well, that was the crucial development. You said earlier, what did Darwin really add? Why do we remember him as the father of evolution? That's because he added the idea of natural selection. Certainly, before Darwin, many scientists and philosophers had speculated about the idea of evolution, and Lamarck had developed a very sort of intricate, complicated system of evolution, which I go through in my book and people understood. But people like Cuvier and in England, Sedgwick and Buckland, these great scientists, Charles Lyell, who was the father of uniformitarian geology and a mentor of Darwin, all these people rejected what Lamarck and other evolutionists were saying because there was no plausible mechanism of how it would happen.
You mean like Darwin, how like a giraffe would develop a longer neck and pass it on to a different generation? That kind of thing.
And that was the most famous of Lamarck's examples, but he used it in many other things. It just didn't seem plausible that that's how it would happen. And with Lamarck, it was internal forces and needs that seemed very romantic and not very materialistic, not very scientific to many people.
Did Darwin reject that also?
Darwin did reject that. He at Cambridge University, and when he left on the voyage of the Beagle, he was a creationist, a Lyellian creationist, but a creationist. It was during the voyage of the Beagle that he encountered, famously, the finches and the mockingbirds on the Galapagos Islands and became convinced that species did evolve, But rather than rush to publication with that insight or even tell anybody about it except a few close friends, he worked on trying to develop a plausible mechanism. In a sense, he was a conservative scientist. Of course, he had a radical idea, and evolution was a radical idea, and he bought it, but he wanted to explain how it worked, not rush to publication. And so he struggled first for a few years to come up with any mechanism, and through his insight by reading Malthus's theory of population and then applying it, this idea of a struggle for survival and a natural selection, he worked out this mechanism within the first 5 years after his return from the voyage of the Beagle, and then spent the next 15 years perfecting and tweaking it and working on it and publishing more books, all of which sort of played into this idea to lay a foundation for revealing his idea. And it turned out, of course, that Alfred Russel Wallace came up with the idea separately, and in one of the great coincidences of the history of science, happened to send his idea to Darwin for review and then passing on to the journals. Mm-hmm. And when Darwin got it, he realized that his priority would be lost if he didn't publish fast, passed all the materials on to Charles Lyell, the great geologist, who then decided to announce them jointly at a meeting of the Linnaeus Society of London in 1858 as the Darwin-Wallace or Wallace-Dallas theory, the transmutation theory, the theory of evolution by natural selection.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can take a few phone calls. Let's go to Robert in Indianapolis. Hi, Robert.
Good afternoon, all the panelists, and good afternoon, America. I have a question for the panelists. I would like the panelists to comment if he knows anything about the religious views of Darwin and his predecessors, mm-hmm. because for many years I have been hearing Darwin portrayed as a godless person, and it is my understanding that Darwin was a devout Christian. I have always had a point that us Christians have taken God out of the theory of evolution, and it was not that Darwin was a godless person.
Dr. Larson?
Good question. There is a lot of discussion and debate, but fortunately there's been some tremendous scholarship on Darwin by people like Janet Brown and James Moore. And we've been able to trace the evolution of Darwin's religious ideas. He grew up in a family whose mother was a traditional Christian and whose father was sort of a deist, a free thinker. And he himself had sort of conventional Anglican ideas through the early part of his life. He thought about actually going in the ministry as an Anglican minister while he was at university in Cambridge, but instead got interested in natural history and got to go on the voyage of the Beagle. He remained sort of conventionally religious in an Anglican sense for a period of time, but then in the 1850s or so, he gradually lost his religion and became what he described himself very clearly as an agnostic. He simply did not know about God and about religion. He once made a famous line that speculating about the mind of God is about by a human is about the same as if a dog would speculate on the mind of Newton, that sort of division. And so he believed it could not be known. Now, his wife was a very devout Christian, Emma Darwin.
And you said he was a creationist when he got on that Beagle.
He certainly was a creationist in a very traditional sense, whether it'd be as many deists would be creationist or whether he'd be a theist. He had those views when he got on board, and he continued to hold them for a while. This was an issue that he discussed a lot because of his wife's devout religious beliefs, and he was concerned about releasing his idea of natural selection because he thought it would have grave consequences for religious belief, mm-hmm. and that how his wife would react to him was always a major troubling aspect. Uh-huh. But then we look at the other people involved, because your questioner didn't limit his question just to Darwin.
I have to limit my interruption here for a second and remind everybody that this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And I apologize for breaking in on you, but we have to take care of business every now and then. But go ahead. Get into the Wallace topic about what his views were and how they compared and why we don't think of, you know, why didn't Wallace beat him to publishing?
Well, Wallace didn't beat him to publishing because he was off on islands in Indonesia, and he sent his theory through Darwin. It was by an insight. But Alfred Russel Wallace, despite being very radical in his politics and radical in his scientific ideas, was deeply spiritual. He believed in a spiritual sense that was larger than that undermined all of the world, and he thought that human mind was actually and human soul was actually a creation of a larger spirit. So there you have the co-discoverer of natural selection, who is very spiritual, and the main proponent of natural selection and Darwinism in America was Asa Gray, a great scientist at Harvard, who was a very devout evangelical Christian. So while Darwin became an agnostic and was clearly an agnostic for the second half of his life, you do have people involved in the process who ranged everything from sort of a New Age spirituality all the way through to very traditional Orthodox Christianity. You do get a variety of viewpoints.
Once Darwin published, were his fears realized about being ostracized?
Oh, Darwin was never ostracized. Darwin was lionized for his views. Now, he certainly had people who would criticize him. There were all the way up to the Prime Minister of England. Gladstone was very critical when Darwin brought out The Descent of Man, which applies a naturalistic evolutionary theory to the origins of everything about humanity, including the human soul and altruistic behavior. That certainly brought some opposition from some people, but he had tremendous respect within the scientific community.
Mm-hmm. And he refined them in works that came afterward.
Darwin was an amazingly active scientist. It is just stunning with the number of books he continually turned out year after year, despite his poor health, starting really from when he came back from the Voyage of the Beagle, all of them dealing with a variety of subjects, from barnacles to orchids to earthworms. But if you look through them all, some of these large volumes, if you look through them all, they all had this line of underlying argumentation in them that advanced the theory of evolution.
All right. Let me bring in these different...
species and different developments.
I hate to interrupt.
And it would enrich his idea.
All right. I hate to do this to you. We have to take a break. It's fascinating. We'll come back and talk lots more about evolution. Also bring on Robert Dennison, who's a biology teacher. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about evolution. With my guest, Edward J. Larson, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and author of the new book, Evolution, The Remarkable History of a Scientific Theory. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. What do people get wrong about evolution, Edward? What is the most common misconception that people have about evolution and Darwin?
Well, in part, it deals with just a sort of a simplistic understanding of the theory that either dates from Darwin's day or at worst is just a belief that it involves, since most people what they're really concerned about is human evolution and that humans mm-hmm. evolved from apes in some way, which of course Darwin even never claimed. What the biggest gap in the general knowledge of evolution is how important genetics is to that story. They tend to, most people when I talk to them ask about fossils. And of course, in this book, I talk about the history of the fossil discoveries right up through today that have been fundamental to developing the modern theory of evolution. But that's secondary to the role that genetics has played from the rediscovery of Mendelian genetics in 1900 through the Neo-Darwinian synthesis and the work of Fisher and Haldane and Wright in the 1930s, and then on up to Dobzhansky, and on up to today, how evolution is being is the modern neo-Darwinian synthesis and the latest developments are being built on the discoveries of genetics, and then now, of course, with the work with DNA. All that is providing a foundation for evolution. That part of the story often gets lost. People will read about Darwin and Wallace and maybe get up to T.H. Huxley, but the work of this century is one of the parts of the story that excited me greatly and is really, when you look at the chapters, the main part of my book.
1-800-989-8255 is the number. We're talking this hour about evolution. I want to bring in another gentleman who is a biology teacher at Jersey Village High School in Houston. He was named Outstanding Biology Teacher by the National Association of Biology Teachers in 1993 and is the past president of the Texas Association of Biology Teachers. And I'm bringing him in because in the year, the last year, 2003-2004 school year, battles over teaching evolution and the latest incarnation of creation theory called intelligent design were being waged in school board meetings and legislatures in Texas, Missouri, Alabama, Georgia, Ohio, Oklahoma, Montana, and Mississippi. And the fight continues to go on. Robert Dennison, thanks for joining us. Robert, are you there? We're losing Robert Dennison?
I'm here.
Hi. The battle, have you been watching from the sidelines of these battles to bring back creationism into the biology class, or have you experienced it personally?
I've experienced it personally.
Tell us about it.
The State Board of Education, our state board has the power to approve or reject textbooks, and this year we had biology books were up for adoption this past summer. And there were 11 books up for adoption, and there was an active campaign on the part of the Discovery Institute and their fellow intelligent design proponents to weaken the coverage of evolution in the books, was how they put it. They wanted more weaknesses of evolution taught. And so I was one of many, many people who testified before the State Board of Education to convince them to adopt the books as they were without requiring any changes.
Mm-hmm. Can a biology teacher in Texas include the story of creation in the evolution curricula if you wanted to?
No, that would not be appropriate. That we have in Texas what we call essential knowledge and skills, which is our minimum standard for teaching in every discipline. And in science, evolution is one of those standards, and there's no mention of religion.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's you would not be allowed to teach religion in a science class.
How much time do you spend on teaching evolution in your class?
From day one till the end of the year.
Really?
It's infused throughout the curriculum. It's biology, so I don't know how to teach biology without having evolution present every day.
And the students basically understand it?
Oh, certainly, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's no more important idea. I can't imagine them not understanding biology if they didn't understand evolution.
Do you ever get pressure from the parents or the teachers to include creation?
No. Occasionally there will be a question from a student, which we can discuss, or a parent might have a question, but no real challenges, no real problems.
Mm-hmm. And do you just then view this battle as something that's going to continue for until who knows when?
What I would want everyone to be aware of is that the battle is maybe a social one, a political one. It's not a battle where real science is being done, and my fear is that the public thinks, because of these campaigns, that there is some active debate among scientists about evolution, and of course there's not. If you go to a science conference or read scientific journals, there's no mention of these so-called weaknesses of evolution that they wanted to put into our books.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an active debate. There's lots of debate about evolution, lots of debate about mechanisms and rates, modes of evolution, but no debate at all about whether or not evolution occurred. And so, these intelligent design people, if they, as I said before the State Board, if they actually have discovered viable scientific evidence that would overthrow or even alter our views of evolution, they need to be out there promoting it at scientific conferences, putting it in scientific journals. The rewards, if they could be successful, the rewards in that would be just tremendous. That's what science is all about. The greatest rewards in science come from overturning accepted doctrine, improving our understanding of the natural world. If they were sincere that they had scientific ideas along these lines, they'd be out there at those conferences, and then eventually, if their ideas were accepted, they'd be in the books, they'd be in the classroom. But, instead their take is to go to circumvent that entire process, go straight to state boards of education, go straight to local school boards, and try to convince them there's some big controversy when you and I and Professor Larson all know there's not.
All right. I want to thank you for taking time to talk with us.
My pleasure.
Robert Dennison is a biology teacher at the Jersey Village High School in Houston, Texas, and an outstanding biology teacher of the National Association of Biology Teachers in 1993, and past president of the Texas Association of Biology Teachers. We're talking this hour about evolution with my guest, who's written a book of the very same name, Evolution, The Remarkable History of a Scientific Theory, Edward J. Larson, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, also of Summer for the Gods. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Ed, do you get into this debate a lot?
When you're talking about the remarkable history of this particular idea, you can't avoid it. It has been involved from the very beginning, as was just discussed. It's still an issue today, but it was also an issue back in Darwin's days, and how that was dealt with, how that interplayed into the underlying theory as part of the rich tapestry, how the evolution has responded to that, how the evolution theory of evolution, how indeed the theory of evolution by natural selection continues to evolve over time, how it continues to develop. It's not frozen in time in Darwin's day. It wasn't frozen in time in Fisher's day and the neo-Darwinian synthesis. We continue to have new ideas. Some people take those ideas and use them to challenge it. Other people use them to push it forward, and that's part of the story. Because of my past, having written a book, say, on the Scopes trial, of course, I can't leave that out. So that in a fashion appears and put in historical context. Looking at the debate helps one understand the underlying idea.
How come you dedicate your book to Ernst Mayr?
Because he's such a remarkable human being. Ernst Mayr is the one of the last surviving founder, as it were, of the modern neo-Darwinian synthesis. He's 100 years old. On July 5th of this year, and I dedicate it to him in commemoration of that 100th anniversary. He has been a key developer. He was born, his early work is he worked started work in science so early that he was a Lamarckian. Neo-Lamarckianism was very strong in the early 1900s. And he started doing his first work with birds in the South Pacific. He was still a Lamarckian. He evolved. His ideas have evolved on the thinking on evolution, and he continues to publish. Indeed, last year, I believe, he brought out four new books, one of them with Jared Diamond. That sort of contribution to the history of evolution should be acknowledged, and I hope many people will join me in celebrating the 100th birthday of this remarkable man.
We're talking about evolution this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Edward J. Larson, author of a new book, Evolution, The Remarkable History of a Scientific Theory. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in before we have to go. Let's go to Brad in Salt Lake City. Hi, Brad.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, quickly.
It seems to me that in the evolution of scientific ideas in general, it's always been shifting paradigms that have been that have contributed major ideas and discoveries. And what my question is whether or not any substantive contributions have been made to our understanding or theories of the mechanics of evolution by anybody in the intelligent design camp.
I certainly don't know of any having been made yet. If you talk about the latest sort of developments in intelligent design, of course, if you go back, we started this conversation talking about Georges Cuvier, whose work was fundamental and continues to be fundamental. It's 200 years old now, but fundamental in the work of science. And he, of course, believed, I don't know if he'd call it intelligent design, but certainly in special creation and an intelligent force acting here. You have people, and you also have many sincere evolutionists, important evolutionists like Alfred Russel Wallace, who David Lack, Francis Collins, the head of the Human Genome Project today, who believe that God is somehow involved in the process, at least when it comes to the development of higher human attributes. Now, that isn't key to the neo-Darwinian synthesis, certainly, and certainly it's rejected by people like Bill Hamilton and E.O. Wilson, so it's a controversial area. But these are people involved in the process. But none of these people would identify themselves as part of the modern intelligent design movement.
You said that it's a very exciting time for evolutionists. Now, what do you mean by that?
It's exciting because we're finding so many new ways that evolution could be pushed forward. Lynn Margulis up at Massachusetts is working about how acquired genomes, how genetic material can be introduced into the cell, say, by viruses. There's increased study of the role of hybridization. These are all avenues beyond the random mutations that feature so prominently in the traditional neo-Darwinian synthesis. New ways for genetic mutations, and of course we know that how the evolutionary process works are these mutations, these genetic changes, then being selected by changes in the environment. We're getting a richer view of how that could happen. Scientists are very actively involved in this. It's not a stagnant field caught in the past. It's a very dynamic, evolving theory.
And it also has new tools, as you mentioned, DNA now, instead of just looking at the fossils themselves.
Certainly a better understanding of DNA has been crucial. All of the developments of the past century, so many of them have hinged on developments in genetics. First, a general understanding of how genetics works, but then thanks to understanding the DNA structure itself from Watson-Crick and the better studies we now have through working with modern genetic technologies, it's opening up whole new levels of understanding, whole new levels of appreciation, better understanding of what a species is and how to differentiate them. This is an exciting time in evolutionary thought.
Well, I'd like to thank you for a truly exciting book. This is a terrific book. If anybody wants to read the history of evolution and all the players, not just Darwin, you've really gone through the whole history of all the relevant players and in a very well-written method, and I applaud you for this book. Thank you very much for being our guest. Edward J. Larson is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Summer for the Gods. His new book is The Remarkable History of a Scientific Theory, Evolution, The Remarkable History. He's professor of history and law at the University of Georgia, and his new book, as I say, is Evolution, The Remarkable History of Scientific Theory, just out by Random House. Also joining us this hour, Robert Dennison, who is the biology teacher at Jersey Village High School in Houston, Texas. Our program is produced and directed by Karen Vergoth and Ned Heist, and we had help today from audio engineers Matt Galick and Rigo Cardi in New York. Kevin Waite is our technical director. Our director is Charles Breakfast. Also, he produces our webpage, and you can always surf over to our webpage and get information you might have missed on Science Friday. And we had help from NPR librarians Kim Oleski and Alphonse Finn. Also, if you want to write to us, send your old-fashioned type letters to Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. And as always, you can send us suggestions for programming and click on the links we have put up there for you. And also Science Friday's Kids Connection is on the website. We make free educational materials for your use. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.